Yeah, just wanted to show you the website which Ben Denham has put together with Melinda for the project, just to let you know it's there. And so it has some information about some of the events that we've had so far. So Antipode in China last year, and there's some recordings related to that, and Other Worlds in this one, Another World in this one, Gerald Manane's fiction. Yeah, so we're updating as we go, and building an archive of recorded material and so on that's on there. So go and have a look at that if you get a chance, or if you're interested in the project. Okay, so this is a work in progress and speculative and open to critique and revision, and it builds on some foundational work that we're doing in Other Worlds, the Other Worlds project, and it's very much a sort of abstract, general way of coming at some of these questions. So for the Antipode in China event, I gave a paper there where I began by questioning whether we can meaningfully apply general terms to ideas like world literature. So what, say, can Australia and China be said to share? I might just change my glasses. In that paper, I argued that that certain terms like climate change, global capitalism, had now become general conditions of being, that it doesn't matter what part of the planet you inhabit, even the remotest parts among indigenous tribes are now deeply affected by both these things. This paper, like the others today, responds to the provocation partly put in place by J.M. Kurtzsayer through his projects Literatures of the South, which dovetails into and informs Other Worlds. So in J.M. Kurtzsayer's project has three nodes: Southern Africa, Australia, and Argentina. The question then is, are there ideas of the South that might be meaningfully applied, that might in turn help us to come to terms with what might be held in common by peoples of the Southern Hemisphere? So again, like Meg, the hemispheric South, the Southern Hemisphere. Although it might be called by different names by different cultures, I wanted to start by asserting that there is a relation to the North, South, East and West, or that there are relations that are objective conditions that can be applied to all people in all places. This doesn't relate to the particular logics of any particular culture and doesn't depend on a knowledge of the magnetic poles or access to instruments that detect magnetism, or to specific geographical techniques of mapping. Rather, it relates to the facts of our planet's relations to the sun and its orbit around the sun, and the tilt of its axis at 23 degrees as it rotates on that axis. And this is apparent to all cultures through the movements of the sun and the stars and their positions in the sky, to the changing of the seasons and the climate and the environment they inhabit. So as I say, and I'll touch on a little bit later, this is understood by different cultures in different ways, but it can be understood. One of the ways it can be understood is in Western cartographical terms. So another thing that provoked this paper was the paper by Ben Etherington in the Antipodean China, where he was talking about, citing Paul Celan. I'm not sure if he's talking about that today, but we'll see. Where he spoke of the idea of the meridian as a line of connection in literature. So the meridian lines run on a north-south axis and correspond to what we call longitude. Ben didn't mention the other lines used in cartography that run on an east-west axis. These are called parallels and are related to latitude. At first glance, or looking at these lines on the globe skeptically, they might seem to be arbitrary. Yet though they are abstract, they're not arbitrary. Both lines relate to the position of the sun. Both lines relate to time, and both lines relate to temperature or zones of climate. In his book Atlas, the French philosopher Michel Serre underlines the deep etymological connection between time and weather, which is apparent in the French word temps, which means time and weather at once. The connection is apparent in English in the words temporal and temperature. The meridian line refers to the position of the sun at midday. So we're familiar with time zones, though these have been adjusted to human convenience and distorted by daylight saving and so on. The meridian then most obviously describes a relation to time, with regions of the south and the north sharing time zones. Australia shares time zones with Asia, South Africa shares time zones with Africa and southern, central and northern Europe, Argentina with Nova Scotia and Greenland. Each of these regions is connected through the fact that it is midday at the same time in each. That is midday when the sun is at whatever zenith it's capable of attaining, depending on the latitude, comes at the same time in each. The meridian also relates to the weather, but I'll turn to this in a moment. In contrast, the parallels or lines of latitude most obviously describe a relation to climate. The Earth is divided into climate zones, polar, temperate, and tropical. These lines of latitude are also not arbitrary. They also relate to the position of the sun. At the December solstice in the southern hemisphere, the sun is directly overhead at midday along and near the Tropic of Capricorn. The same is true of the Tropic of Cancer at the June solstice in the northern hemisphere. Yet as we know, the summer and winter seasons are inverted in the two hemispheres. So there's an objective relation between north and south along the meridian line. This is a relation of climate. The southern summer is the northern winter. A kind of inversion then is instantiated. Equally, in terms of the parallels or lines of latitude, there is an objective relation between south and south through the weather. As for example, Sydney, Cape Town and Buenos Aires and Adelaide more or less sit within the same southern temperate zone, more or less on the same latitude, around 34 degrees south. Yet there's also a relation of inversion or difference south to south, as well as south to the north that lie on different meridians. My day might be your night as the Earth moves, daylight and nighttime move around the world from meridian to meridian. And there's a further objective difference between night and day. While south to south and north to north, the sky and the positions of the stars are the same, there are, of course, marked differences between the southern sky and the northern sky. The movements of the sun and the moon, the waxing and waning of the moon, the position and movements of the stars have been tracked by all peoples at all times and are intimately related to the sense they have made of the world through religion, stories, science, a living from the land through indigenous knowledge, agriculture, and other kinds of technology. These things are not only understood, they themselves affect us directly, whether it is hot or cold, light or dark, wet or dry, abundant or desertified. So too, the climate, the seasons, the environment mark all people in all places and in some ways shape them in their cultures. There is then an objective south, though it might not be called the south by all peoples. It involves a relation to its polar opposite along a meridian, and it doesn't have to be understood as up or down, powerful or weak. It involves a relation to the movement of the Earth, both through the course of any given day as the Earth spins on its axis, and through the course of a year as the Earth orbits the Sun, relating to latitudes and parallels. So there are commonalities and differences between the north and south then. So the next part of the paper will turn to theoretical readings to attempt to bring some of what is at stake into focus, hopefully. In the Anti-Oedipus, Deleuze and Guattari use the terms longitude and latitude to describe a different kind of individuation, which they call the body without organs. And they imagine an egg traversed by longitude and latitude. This idea, which they draw from Antonin Artaud, is famously obscure. In A Thousand Plateaus, they expand on the idea, and I think it becomes clarified, again using longitude and latitude, again to define a different kind of individuation. This time they turn to a concept which was first developed by the 14th century scholastic philosopher Duns Scotus at the University of Paris. So Duns Scotus controversially developed an understanding of the divine or God, he was a monk, as being immanent rather than transcendent, and involving a univocity of being where all things are one thing, and he coined the term hexeity. This is taken from the Latin word hec, or this, and is defined by the OED as follows. So that's kind of written up there. The quality implied in the use of this as this man, thisness, here-ness and now-ness. As Deleuze and Guattari explain in further developing the concept, hexeity might refer to the individuality of a day, a room with everything in it. This would be an individual, according to the concept of hexeity. So Deleuze and Guattari's development of the concept might be better understood by attending to the use they make of longitude and latitude in A Thousand Plateaus. So drawing on Spinoza, who defines individuals as being drawn together, the drawing together of elements arranged in a certain ratio of speeds and slownesses. Longitude is described by Deleuze and Guattari as a ratio of speeds and slownesses. That is, a body might be understood by all the extensive parts that comprise that body, the molecules that comprise it, for example. There's another way of thinking of this, however, which is consistent both with Spinoza and with many indigenous knowledge systems, including Australian Aboriginal understandings. This way understands individuals not through reference to some ideal, such as a species, like mankind, or a function, doctor or lawyer, or quantitative psychologist, which I've just discovered is a thing. Rather, the individual is defined by the relations they enter into. So an individual is defined by the relations they enter into and the relationships. So this might be clarified by offering a specific example drawn from non-Indigenous readings of concepts by Indigenous people. So I'm just drawing on, and I claim no expertise here, drawing on readings from anthropologists, John Morton, T.G.H. Strelow. And I'm trying to follow the description of the structure rather than presuming to recount the real knowledge. Still, with these caveats, I think that some of these ideas allow us to understand something of what's at stake with this idea of thinking in terms of relationships rather than universals. And these relate to the Arunta people of the central desert regions of Australia. So here, rather than there being a general notion of the universal and the universal concept of the individual as a particular thing, which is somehow divorced from the world which has brought one into existence, there's an understanding of the individual as being both identified with a still present history and individualized through systems of relationship. Identifying the individual through relationship involves considering the itinerary of an individual in relation to traditions of secular knowledge and sacred knowledge, traditions which are maps of a territory over which the individual, whose identity is determined by his or her relations to that tradition and the kinship system which exists within it, passes. You are who you are according to this worldview in respect to the relations into which you enter. The relations themselves are particular and are divided along gender lines. For a male, you have a particular conception totem. You're born into a particular skin group. There are 8 for the Arunta. And your mother's brothers, as the knowledge of the male is derived patrilineally, are a particular people of a certain country. Your father is of a particular people and country, and your wife's father is of a particular people and country. Your conception totem corresponds to a particular site and a particular ancestor, and relates to you to specific sets of knowledges in relation to that place and that ancestral being of whom you form an aspect. You are further related to the general knowledges of your people and more closely to the knowledge of your father and your mother's brothers and your wife's father. All of these relations find particular expression in an individual, as access to these knowledges needs to be won through respect of the law and the undergoing of processes of initiation. The knowledges then are also particular in that the relations occurring in a certain place have a specific set of possibilities attached to them. The possible permutations within this set of possibilities are necessarily vast. Relational identity then both places and is concerned with place. Although this doesn't mean, as the shifts involved in these permutations indicate, that a person is fixed in place. Rather, the person and the knowledge available to the person constantly shifts within this place. Relational identity then speaks of a tradition very different to the Western traditions of universals, which displace and take the individual out of relation to his or her place, so that the centre can reside only within that individual, which is necessarily understood in universal terms, paradoxically through being emptied of any individuality. Such an empty category, the universal woman or man, every man, is in effect no one. Ulysses, often seen as a prototype of the universal man, says, "I am nobody," and escapes from the Cyclops he is blinded. Yet Ulysses is also who he is through the relationships he has entered into. These are not simply relations of kinship, the king of Ithaca, father to Telemachus, husband to Penelope, comrade in arms to the great Greek warriors of the Trojan Wars, and so on. They're also relations of knowledge, which he earns and is given by the gods, and relationships with place. His journey plays a large part in who he is. So longitude, I would argue, might be in this way associated with relational particulars. These are not universals as such, but they speak directly to the real world and its conditions, and therefore claim an applicability that is not arbitrary. Longitude might mean the particles of which we are each composed. It might equally refer to the particular relationships we enter into. Deleuze and Guattari, again drawing on Spinoza, describe latitude as the capacities of a body, the effects it is capable of. For Spinoza, everybody corresponds to a degree of power, but this is subject to change. An affect marks movement from one degree of power to another. Again, this might be rendered more complex and hopefully clarified by turning back from Deleuze and Guattari to the work of Duns Scotus. In this case, I'm relying on the descriptions provided by Emile Brehier, French historian of philosophy. So Brehier notes that Duns Scotus was appalled by the definition that the great Islamic philosopher Averroes gave to individuality. For Averroes, any given species or attribute partakes of one kind of being, which is then distributed among the individuals of that kind. The single being might be compared to water. Water everywhere has the same quality. It can, however, be distributed among different vessels. So if one thinks of the species humankind, or those beings who share what I might loosely call here the attribute of humanity, the species would then be like water, with each of us would be like receptacles of the water. But for Duns Scotus, this is a grievous error. In place of this, Duns Scotus develops a quite different understanding of the individual in relation to the attribute, one that is in turn made use of by Deleuze in seeking to explain the conception of expression that Deleuze sees in the work of Spinoza. Now, that's in his book, Spinoza, Expressionism in Philosophy. So here I'll move the discussion from Spinoza's precise definitions of the attributes to the idea of qualities more generally. We can think of a quality, say humanity, as being like the colour blue. Within the quality of blue, there are, for Duns Scotus, an infinity of shades of blue. Each individual corresponds to a particular shade of blue, which in turn represents a degree of power. Deleuze takes this still further, arguing in line with his reading of Spinoza that we each correspond to a degree of power, but that our power shifts as we grow weaker or stronger due to the relations we enter into. These shifts in degrees of power in turn are felt or sensed as affects. So affects are becomings, as Deleuze and Guattari famously state. We change as we shift between one degree of power and the next. So too, the more affects a body is capable of, the more it can do. All of this might be related back to an idea of the world itself. The hexaedy involves both what Deleuze and Guattari call longitude and latitude. On the one hand, longitude, it involves the complex set of relations that comprise an individuality. On the other hand, latitude, it involves the capacities open to the world, what it can do. The polar regions are frozen, and certain things are possible there. Very different things are possible at the equator, among rainforests, or in the temperate regions. At the same time, these possibilities are susceptible to change. As the climate changes, different things become possible. Different things are no longer possible. The possibilities open to a city without water differ to those open to a city with water security, for example. I want to argue that the latitudes of the South carry capacities that are specific to these locations. So too, those capacities differ in consequence of what is particular to those locations, through the relationships that comprise them, historically and contemporaneously, through the longitudinal lines that intersect with the lines of latitude. In terms of longitude then, Australia, for example, comprises different sets of understandings, knowledge systems, cultural and historical relations to those present in Southern Africa or South America. So it's not possible to do justice to the complexity of these relations, but in place of this, I wanted to show a few images. Where other people have attempted to represent some of the conditions that inhere in the South and relations between North, South, East and West. So my thanks go to Melinda Jewell for helping to track down some of these images. So this I might need my other glasses here. So this first slide is a real-time-ish map of wind currents in the world. You can see there's a current cyclone. I'll just play this for about 30 seconds or so.
In the center, in the equatorial regions of the Earth, you'll see this pulsating flow of smaller clouds, but with much brighter white tops. And that's the local edge tropical convergence zone. That's where air.
Okay, so I'm just with this, I'm just kind of trying to indicate some of the complexity that I was talking about for the complexities of relationships. So that's kind of one set with the weather, and none of these things obviously I have any genuine sort of knowledge of. Another set is indigenous cultures. This is a map Melinda found, a site called Landmark, which offers sets of information about indigenous cultures around the world. Some very detailed information about Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island cultures on this site. And again, different sets of indigenous knowledges pertaining to Argentina. Fourth, there's questions of colonization. And again, there's maps online which sort of show these, although I was looking through with Ben Denham a bit earlier, and some of them are a little bit imprecise, the ones that we just got from the internet, Wikicommons. But this is showing, you know, a general overview of population movements. But something like this reflects, this is 1492 lines of colonization, 1550, 1660, 1754, 1800. You can just see, I think, Sydney as a dot. And actually, this building was built, I think, in 1813. Is that right? About that, 1816? So again, this is at a time when Australia was just colonised areas of Australia were just Tasmania and Sydney Basin. 1822, 1850, 1885, 1914, and so on. Okay, so another very interesting website which Melinda found which is really worth looking at is one that maps movement of refugees, and it does it by year and shows from where people moved and to where they moved. I'll just quickly show that. So that this is that's Iraq, but that's 2016. And then there's some maps representing net migration. So again, as I say, it's just an index, basically saying it's complicated. But I wanted to make some brief comments about some of these and the metaphor of the global north and south, which carry ideas of colonization. And in those metaphors, the north is the seat of power, the south is subject to this power. This colonization, too, has occurred in real terms, often from north to south. And the question I'll just leave as an open question is, what happens when a worldview is transported from the north to the south? I went to Sydney University as an undergraduate, postgraduate. The motto of my alma mater is Sidere mens idem mutato. So no doubt aware of the potentially political sensitive nature of the motto, the university now officially translates this as the stars change, the mind remains the same. Yet when I went there in the 1980s, we were told this was to be translated as the same mind under a different sky. So my general question is, what happens when a mind leaves one place and comes to a place that is differently disposed toward the sun, the stars, the climate, the environment? It then interacts with the sun, the stars, the climate, and the indigenous peoples and knowledges that already live in that place, and clashes with potentially these things, which have profound effects. But the question is, to what extent is that the same mind? What could be meant by the concept? And I'll leave it there.